Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, a play written by Tom Stoppard in the mid-60s, is considered a modern masterpiece. It's an absurdist, tragicomic take on life and death, where reality and illusion intermix, and where fate leads our two heroes to a tragic but inevitable end. Starting a week from tonight, you have 7 chances to see Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead at the New Space Theater at CMC in Spring Valley, courtesy of the Sopris Theater Company. And with us today to tell us about it are Tom Cochran, the director of the show. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Luke. Nice to see you.
Good to see you again. And then we have the two heroes. Brendan Cochran is Guildenstern. Hi, Brendan.
Afternoon.
And Nick Garay is Rosencrantz. Hello.
How's it going?
Pretty good. How are you guys?
Doing well.
Yeah, I have to say, your two leading men, Tom, were out there in the other room waiting to come on the air, and they were studying their lines.
Well, that's just how crazy they are.
So does that suit them for these two characters?
Yeah. These guys are great. When I thought about the chance to do this show, these are the first two people I thought of that I wanted involved in it. So
how are they suited for these?
Well, first of all, they're both really, really good actors. And you have to be good actors to be on stage for almost the whole show and be able to be out there, be confident, and, basically carry the evening for people. And I knew these two guys I'd seen do it before and knew it could do it this time. And personality-wise, we talked when we first started thinking about the show and talking to each other that either one could do either role. They really could. But there's just little natural tendencies that I think favor one doing one and one the other.
Well, that sounds very appropriate because, yeah, in a sense, these two characters are halves of a whole.
Exactly, right. And they even get mixed up with who they are. So, the fact that they could interchange roles, we actually talked about doing that. They balked at having to learn the whole show, though. I said, well, why don't you learn the whole thing and then you could switch parts every night?
Just switch nights.
the lights went on. They said, no, that was a little too much.
Huh, how about that? Well, these two characters are pretty clueless.
They are and they aren't. What really intrigues me about this show, one of the things, is how they're funny and they are clueless in a certain way, but how much they mirror most of us in life, the way we go through life. We really don't question. We don't, we take what's given to us. We try and make the best of it and get on with life. And that's pretty much what these guys do in every situation. The fact is what they're given isn't too good in this case, right? But the way they try and cope with it, it makes a very entertaining, funny evening.
Oh, interesting. So there's a trajectory there.
Oh, yes.
They're learning.
Yes, yeah.
They're learning. Yeah. Well, that's good because they start out, well, one critic calls them uncertain of their past, puzzled by the present, and blind to the future.
That's right on, yeah.
Spot on.
So, Nick Garay, how do you approach that as a character actor? How do you embody that?
I take it scene by scene. Just one moment at a time. And really just try to be in the present, right now, like you said, you saw us out in the lobby memorizing. It's a lot to memorize. And there's a lot of back and forth. And like Tom said, the two lead characters, we're on stage the whole time. We don't leave until intermission.
Oh. Yeah.
And the play is about 2.5 to 2 hours, 45 minutes maybe. Yeah. It's a long one.
Huh.
And so we're on there the whole time.
Huh. So, well, that quickfire dialogue, that I've seen the play maybe 30 years ago, yeah, maybe 40. And a lot of the play depends on that quick banter between the two. Was that something that you guys consciously work on? How do you work on that, Brendan?
Yeah, I mean, it's for me, it's repetition, repetition, repetition is the only way to get there with that stuff. A monologue you can eventually memorize, but you've got to have two voices going back and forth like that to get it, that kind of stuff down. And it's that real sort of quick vaudeville style back and forth bantering that can be real tough to learn.
Huh. Yeah.
something we did early on. We got together at his house, Brendan's house, and recorded all our lines together and just listened to him every day like a song.
How about that?
Yeah, so I have his voice, he has mine, and just listen to it when I'm driving, listen to it at work, and just keep it in my head.
So you are literally filled with your characters, right?
Yeah.
Living in that world right now, for sure.
Yeah.
Brendan, how would you describe Guildenstern?
Well, as much as you can differentiate between the two of them, I'd say Guildenstern's sort of the serious-minded. I don't know if I'd go as far as intellectual, but he tries to intellectualize what's going on and sort of constantly trying to get a grasp on the situation and reason his way through it. And we find that as much time as he spends trying to reason out the situations, it doesn't really get him any further. Rosencrantz is a little more easygoing, I think, and just kind of, you know, floats his way through life and is probably happier for it.
And that pisses you off.
Oh, yeah, it? Yeah. Definitely leads to some frustration between the two characters because he's constantly trying to get Rosencrantz on that ship. If we're going to sit down and figure this out and reason it out, and it doesn't really come to anything.
It goes over my head. Everything goes over my head.
And I guess conversely, there's things about Guildenstern that really enrage you too, aren't there?
You know, I don't really think I get angry. I'm more like, there's a line I say that says I'm only good in support. And I feel like I'm his support right there. There's, you know, I'm just there to like, it's okay, don't worry. It'll be okay kind of thing, you know? But I don't see myself getting angry at him. I get more angry at the situation we're in. Like you said, we don't know our future. We don't know our past. And that really scares me. And that's the moment when I get angry. But at him, no.
Well, the future, Tom Cochran, for these characters is an inevitable death, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the title says it all. It's a wonderful thing about particularly Shakespeare, that he can tell you right at the beginning of the play what's going to happen. You know, he says in the first 14 lines of Romeo and Juliet, these two kids are going to die. And yet you spend the next 2 hours watching to see and hoping that they don't, right? And here we know what the future of these guys are. They don't, we do. And yet it's still such an amazing, fascinating ride that they go on to get there. You know, all the while it's inevitable, but they don't know that. And how do they end up where they do is the interesting, intriguing part of it.
And, of course, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern popped up first in literature in Hamlet,
right?
They were minor characters in Hamlet.
Right. I think it's, you know, part of Stopper's genius. He took one of the greatest plays in history and took two minor characters out of it and gave us another great play of modern history, right, out of that.
Was it, you know, it strikes me, just boning up on the play before this interview, it strikes me that the play could, well, it's a product of its time.
It is.
The 60s.
It is.
When a lot of things were being questioned.
Right. Yeah. And I first saw it in 1970 in San Francisco. And I was a undergrad student at UC Berkeley in theater and happened to get to see a production of it. And it, frankly, was a sort of a ground-shifting event for me, because up until that time I thought theater was sort of a fun thing to do, but I didn't really think it really had much. I really thought music is where it was at, or maybe movies, but not theater. And when I saw that play, I realized the unique power of live theater, and it really brought it home to me.
Was that already in the canon in 1970? This play?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was done by ACT. And I think first they did it 3 years in a row, interestingly enough. And they did it with Hamlet 1 year. And I think it was, I just looked it up, the chronology of it. It was, I think it was 69, 70, and 71. right? They did it 3 seasons, part of American Repertory Theater there.
Wow, and it hit Broadway late 60, like 67, 68, something like that.
I think it ended up going on to win the Tony the year it came out and the Pulitzer.
Yeah, right, right.
Yeah.
68, yeah.
So, yeah, it was it reached the West Coast pretty quickly there. Yeah,
I'll bet it did. Yeah. I wonder if these times we're living in today, does this play have a particular resonance during these kind of befuddling times?
I feel it does. I don't know. Ask these younger guys.
Tell me. Yeah, that's a good response. Yeah. Tell me, guys.
No, I think it's definitely applicable for... our generation, you know, we've spent a lot of, I feel like I've spent a lot of the last 10 years of my life questioning what's going on around me and trying to make some sense of things. And it can definitely shed some light on that for me of, you know, what is valuable to assess as far as what's going on in your life. Is it worth examining all that? Are you better off just, you know, sort of letting it fly by you? Yeah. But I think it makes you ask those questions and... you know, I definitely know where I land on that, but
Is that your experience, Nick?
Well, yeah, I mean, we definitely live in a confusing time right now with everything going on in politics and things like that, but not to really get into that. This play definitely does speak to our times. And, like Brendan said, you know, it makes you question those things that you're not sure about. And, you know, his character is doing that throughout the whole play. And my character doesn't, and it's his way of coping with it, maybe coping with the world, his world, and just letting it go. He knows he can't control it, and I mean, it really does speak to what we're going through now.
So it's one of those things. In Hamlet, there's a line about theater holding the mirror up to nature, and that's definitely part of what this play is about, is sort of forcing the audience to take a look at themselves and say, hey, how does this apply to my life?
And that's part of the genius of the play, is the way that Stoppard structured that in the person of the player. Tell me about the player, Tom. Who is the player?
The player is, on the surface, he's the head of a troupe of traveling players who also show up in Hamlet, right? And actually has a little scene with Hamlet in there, where Hamlet asks him to do a particular play and insert a speech that Hamlet has written into it, which tends to upset the king when he sees it. This player on one level is another character out of Hamlet, and we see him backstage, and we sort of learn something about the realities of the lives of players at that time, and that it wasn't all, you know, glamour and glitz and fun and games, you know. But on another level, he's sort of the knowing voice that comes in and watches it all go by and sort of gets the idea of what's going on. We can almost say at times he seems omniscient. He knows what's going to happen, it seems like, and is one step ahead of the game, where these guys are always two steps behind it, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm. And yet, I've read snippets of the play, and I'm trying to remember my memories of the player. They're not really there, but I like how you said omniscient, because he is sort of the godlike presence that sort of accepts Rosencrantz and Guildenstern for who they are,
right,
despite their foibles.
Yeah. There's people are constantly getting them mixed up, and there's one moment near the end of the play where I think it's you, Rosencrantz, or no, it's Guildenstern. Who are we, right? And he says, you are Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, and he identifies them correctly. Uh-huh. And it's one of the few times in the play it happens, right?
Huh. Yeah. Another one of the overriding themes in the play is the coin flipping.
Yes.
That always lands on heads. So what's the point of that? Tell me more. What's Stoppard's point there?
Well, it's the fact that things are not natural here. We're experiencing something that is totally outside the realm of normal possibility, probability. And they are caught up in that from the beginning of the play.
Yeah.
They are spinning coins. They have been spinning coins when the play starts, and they continue through the first part of the play. And it's I think a very funny scene, because I mean the way the two of them try to cope with that thing, the fact that, you know, we've got 87 or 86 times now it's come down heads. What does that mean? You know, how come I'm losing 86 times in a row? How come I'm winning? You know, I'm happy about it, but I'm sad for my friend. What do I do with this, right? And you can imagine, you know, being in that situation where nothing is going your way or everything is going in your way. Uh-huh. But yeah, Guildenstern is continually during this trying to figure out what it does mean, right? And then the player comes in with the tragedians and they get involved in the game, and yeah, it gets even weirder. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's all random then. Is that what the message is?
Well, it can be, I think. Yeah.
It makes you question it. Is it random, or is it, you know, is it meant to be?
But yeah, the player does say at one point, he's sort of he's talking about how theater works, and the play works on a lot of different levels. So it sort of talks about how theater relates to our lives, our real lives. And you're not quite sure if he's talking about our fate or a script, but we're sort of seeing these two characters existing within a script that they can't escape from, because they are characters in Hamlet. They're not real people. They can't quite make decisions for themselves because it is written. Right. But how does that relate to us in our real lives? Is our fate written for us, or do we have free will? It's bringing up all those questions for us.
Right. Huh.
He provides a lot of questions during this play, and I think very few answers.
Yeah. Is that what makes it absurdist?
Could be. It could be. I've studied absurdist drama, and I'm still not sure exactly what that means. You know, it is saying that all life is absurd, or that humans do absurd things in real life? Or I'm not sure what the creates absurdist theater. It's all theater that maybe seems silly, but also leads us to think about things that are very serious.
Well, it seems semi-absurd that there are a lot of questions posed but no answers. It's either that or hopeless. What is it?
Yeah,
a little like life, though.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
You end up with a lot more questions than answers a lot of the time, I think.
Yeah.
Huh.
And I think we try and decide what our answers are to these situations, whether they work or not, you know, is it leaves it up to the future to say that's true, whether that's true or not. But yeah.
Okay. Well, I don't think I'm spoiling anything by asking this.
Okay.
Because it's embodied in the title. We know, and we already said this, we know they're going to die.
We're going to die.
So I have to ask the actors, your dying scene. Tell me about your dying scene. And what does it mean as an actor to die on stage?
Well, it's not as great as the tragedians dying scenes. They get to have fun with it. Ours is a little more subtle. And without giving away the end, you know, it's just we're more questioning what, where do we go from here kind of thing. I mean, even at the end, they still don't accept or realize that they're going to die. Because the way, the way it works, it's kind of like Groundhog Day. Every scene starts from the beginning again, or for them, it starts from the beginning. And every time they go to sleep and they wake up, they're like, okay, where are we? Okay, well,
starting from step one again.
Exactly, yeah. Starting from step one. So who knows? Do they die right then, or do they die later on? I mean, but so we don't get that great dying, the tragedians get
the tragedians are lucky one on that. I think each one of them gets to die at least three or four times on stage throughout the show.
Oh wow, sounds like a cartoon.
Like
Wile E. Coyote falling off
yes,
the cliff.
Yes, very melodramatic.
Yeah.
Oh, how about that?
And they make a big point of dying is their trade as actors.
Right.
I mean, right. Yeah, they're folk. what is it called? Their skill is tragedy. That's what they focus on. And tragedy, you die at the end. So that's their special skill.
Yeah. So, it's what they do best.
Yeah.
And there's some great lines about what does it mean to die, right? Do actors really die, you know? Or is, you know, what is death? What does that mean? And and that play, it plays into the play all the way through. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How about that? So a week from tonight is opening night. Do you guys feel ready?
I think we're at a good place where we need to be right now.
We're off book, at least. I mean, not 100%, but at least we don't have those in our hands. We can move around, and right now we got our brains working, you know?
If I'm not scared going into opening night, it's not really worth it.
It definitely, I'll tell you what, it definitely drives you and pushes you to make sure you got those lines memorized when you have a little bit of nervousness in you, when you're like, okay, clock is running, and we're counting down the days. It really makes you focus. So.
What kind of strategies do you employ to remember your lines, to get them in?
Something I learned a long time ago is reading it, repetition, and recording it, and listening to it like a song. Because when you listen to a song over and over, you don't think about it, and then all of a sudden you know the words because you've been listening to it. So with my voice recorder, I'll just, when I'm driving, when I'm at work, any free time I have, just put the headphones on and read it too, so I could see the words in my head and know where I'm going with it. But it really is just repetition. That's what works for me. Everyone's different. Everyone memorizes their own way, but that helps me.
How about you, Brendan?
Well, for me, yeah, repetition's really important. I'm a pretty kinesthetic learner, so I have to actually be saying the words for them to stick in my brain. And really, being on stage, walking, connecting the movement to the language is really important for me. So being able to put it on its feet and actually walk your way through a scene while you're talking through your scene is really key for it to all cementing in my brain.
But learning the lines is just half the task at hand.
Yeah, I've always believed you can't act until you got the lines memorized. You really can't, because if you're thinking about your lines and you think about what you're going to say next, you're not in the moment. And you're not thinking about what you're going to be doing with the other actors on stage. You might not be listening to the other actors. You're in your own head trying to think, okay, what's next? What am I going to say next? So if you really have those lines memorized and you don't have to think about them, they just come out natural. That's when the fun begins. That's when the actual acting. We found some really funny moments once we got the scripts out of our hand.
Oh, yeah.
You know? So.
Now, to be... give these guys their due. They're doing a great job. They're in a really good place for, you know, we've got six more rehearsals, and we're looking forward to those, and we need those, but we're in a great shape to get this on the...
Well, I couldn't help but notice the same surnames, Tom Cochran and Brendan. Are you guys related?
Distantly. He's my son.
How about that? So that adds an extra dimension to things.
Yeah, and I think he's been aware of this play since he was about 6 years old. He's always wanted to do it. And last year, I thought, you know, this might be the time for him to do it. And I've actually directed this play, I figured out, 37 years ago. And
here?
Actually at the Crystal Theater over here.
Oh, okay.
When it was still a theater. And with Bob Wiley and Michael Kreich as Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. And it was time to do it again and time to let this guy get his chance.
Is this the first time you've directed, Brendan?
Not the first time.
No. We've had a few together.
Yeah.
Got last spring doing One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Got to be on stage together for the first time.
Oh,
so that
cool.
was a really cool experience.
That would be a fun one.
Yeah.
I managed to stay off stage for most of my childhood. I wasn't really interested until I hit high school and sort of moved back to the Valley a few years ago, and have gotten steadily sucked into that life and kind of pushing it further and further. And yeah, that's sort of become my reason for being recently. So
well, Soper's Theater, it sounds like a great Soper's Theater Company, it sounds like a great venue for that. It sounds like it's a great mix of college theater and community theater. Is that right?
It's true, and it always has been since I got involved with it back in the 70s. And it was been a wonderful, and I'm really glad that Brad and Gary are carrying on that tradition and really working with some really wonderful seasoned actors, professional actors in some cases, and getting a chance for younger actors to work with them, I think, is invaluable. Mm. Right. It's when I was involved with the theater program and getting my MFA at Florida State, their graduate acting program is with a professional company. And so those actors that are in their 20s get to work with professionals of all ages from the East Coast. And I think that model is really valuable.
Hmm. Yeah, it's good stuff that you're doing up there. Yeah. Well, let's cover a couple of the mundane topics of the thing. You've got 7 performances scheduled. It starts a week from tonight.
Right.
Tickets at the door. How do people get tickets?
You know, I'm going to turn this over to Brad Moore here, sitting here with us, and let him give
Brad
all the particulars.
Well, hello. So, yes, let me share some of the information. So, we open a week from tonight on the 20th. Shows are at 7 o'clock. And anyway, you can call our box office line, which is 947-8177, and leave a message. You can also order tickets at eventbrite.com. So there are tickets online, and so you can either call and make a reservation, or you can order those tickets online. You can also get tickets at the door. We do try to get people to make reservations at least, so that we can kind of control crowds and that sort of thing. But we would love to have you come up and see the show. It plays, as you were saying, 7 performances. So it's Friday and Saturday of next week, with a Sunday matinee at 2, and then it's Thursday, Friday, Saturday with a Sunday matinee the last week, so we close on the 29th at 2 o'clock.
That's great. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for joining Express Yourself today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Luke.
Thanks for having us.
All right, stay with me. There is more to come on today's Express Yourself.